The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Clinical Microbiology is presented by Dr. Gerald Blackburn.
They used to title this particular lecture something about Gram stains because they ask those questions. And if you see anything that's in gold, it's where my prior medical residents have told me or other spies have told me that these have been on the board questions before. So anything in gold, pay attention. So let's talk about skin and soft tissue infections. And they always talk about Gram stains. A gram-positive organism is purple or dark in color, as you see here. And they will probably talk, if it's an uncomplicated presentation, what are the odds of that in a board question? If it is an abscess, it's Staph aureus. If it's a cellulitis, it's almost always strep. How do you tell the difference on Gram stain? Well, Staph aureus is in clusters, as you see at the bottom. And I'll show you a streptococcal Gram stain in a minute. This is an old drug that many of you have maybe never used, Nafcillin, but that is considered the drug of choice for methicillin-susceptible Staph bacteremia. And they have asked questions about, well, what if you're allergic but not anaphylactic? Cephalosporins. So what are all the options to treat a MRSA? They are listed there, and it dawned on me that another drug that I've never used, Teflaro or Ceftaroline, is also a cephalosporin with MRSA activity. But if I were asking the questions, it would be focusing on the fact that you can't use daptomycin for pneumonia, and you should not be using Zyvox or linezolid for bacteremia. And most of you have seen and probably prescribed either Bactrim or clindamycin for soft tissue infections. That's a typical strep cellulitis. Again, strep does not usually cause an abscess. If it's an abscess, if it's frank pus, it's almost always Staph aureus, absent any unique history. And if it is a diffuse cellulitis, it almost always is streptococcal. The Gram stain is different, as you see at the bottom, in that these are chains, not in clusters. They like to ask about erysipelas. And where the yellow arrow is a picture that is probably 30 years old, but apparently it still shows up when demonstrating or asking about erysipelas, which is a streptococcal infection of the superficial layers of the skin, which you might think is no big deal. But before antibiotics, this was lethal and could happen to anybody just from minor trauma. Additional strep syndromes, endocarditis, I'll talk about that this afternoon. Hopefully every one of you knows about strep bovis, also galalyticus, which is sort of interchangeable with the bovis, causing or being associated with any GI malignancy. It used to be strep bovis endocarditis colon cancer. It's now strep bovis bacteremia. You don't have to have endocarditis, and it's not just colon cancer. It's any cancer of the GI tract. Group A strep, necrotizing fasciitis. What's the key there? Pain out of proportion to what you initially see. That's that flesh-eating bacteria. That's that bacteria then that can lead to loss of a limb in a perfectly otherwise previously normal individual. Pain out of proportion. Sometimes their characteristic is they're sent home from the ER, blown off as, well, I don't see much, and they're sent home on NSAIDs. Probably some trauma, You'll be fine. They're back in a few hours with full-blown necrotizing fasciitis. And there's a difference that's listed there between toxic shock syndrome associated with staph versus strep. Again, group A strep, necrotizing fasciitis, is pain out of proportion. What about Clostridia? Clostridia, what's the key there? I always ask the residents, could this patient have Clostridia as the cause of their necrotizing and fasciitis? And the answer is no, because he or she is still alive in that bed that we're looking at. It moves within hours. And most necrotizing infections associated with perineal, GI, type infections are commonly seen in obese diabetics. They're almost always involved anaerobes, and frequently there's a mucous membrane involved, whether it's the vaginal mucosa, the GI mucosa, oral mucosa. If anytime you cross a mucous membrane and have an infection, it's mixed and there's anaerobes. I'm certainly not going to read this to you, but this is an excellent table, and if I were writing a question, it would be based on this table. Why? Because the author of the article here, is considered the expert in these type of infections, Dennis Stevens, and this is a recent New England Journal article, and this is the table I would base that question off of. So highlight that. They've asked questions in the past about diabetic feet, and it seems like they're always going after the organism that they think is commonly associated with diabetics, which is Pseudomonas. I don't think that's really true, but that's the question that they ask. And so when they ask about antibiotics, always include an anti-Pseudomonas drug. Again, I don't think that's terribly true, but the people that write these questions do. These are typical pictures of a necrotizing fasciitis. Almost always diabetic and commonly obese. And the question they ask on this is, okay, you see this, what do you do next? And the answer is surgery. That was the question or answer they were seeking. This is right out of New England Journal of Medicine. That's probably the picture I would show you if I were writing the questions. What does this patient have? Fournier's disease, or Fournier's necrotizing fasciitis. What do you do? Lots of antibiotics, surgery. Antibiotics must have anaerobic activity here, and you can throw the kitchen sink at them, but at least include anaerobic activity and gram-negative. Here's a gram stain of Clostridia. What's the tip-off of a necrotizing fasciitis with Clostridia? There's two tip-offs. One is the gram-positive organisms, probably best seen on the lower picture, and the other is the absence of white cells. And these patients will die in hours if they don't get surgery. So a few other pearls, Clostridium septicum. You grow this in the bloodstream. It's associated with a GI or GYN malignancy and often seen in folks who have become neutropenic from chemotherapy. Skin popping with so-called black tar heroin, even though this has been known for a long time, it has resurfaced again in my literature, and that's associated with Clostridium botulinum. Cat bites. You all know about cat bites. You all know, hopefully, the organism is usually Pasteurella. And this is in part related to the fact that if you've ever been bitten by a cat or looked at the teeth of a cat, they're very penetrating type injuries. You cannot clean them adequately. You can try, but it's hard to do it because they're so deep and penetrating. What's the drug of choice? Any of those except Keflex. So that would be my question. which of the four drugs should not be used for a cat bite. What about dog bites? Splenectomy. This is an uncommon lethal infection. Anyone who's had their spleen removed for whatever reason, it is recommended that if they sustain a dog bite, no matter how minor, that they be placed immediately on antibiotics. Why? Because of this overwhelming sepsis due to this organism called Capnocytophaga. That's a big deal. Human bites. You can't use clindamycin, it is said, because Eikenella, which is commonly found in human bites, is not susceptible to clindamycin. Rabies. If I were to ask a question, it would probably be around an exposure here in the U.S., and it would probably focus on cats. They are the most common domestic animals with rabies in this country. For a couple reasons. One may be because we tend to immunize our dogs better than we immunize our cats. But the other thing is cats are really nocturnal. So when they're outside at night, they're around bats, skunks, raccoons, and a lot of feral cats. Aeromonas is a popular question that folks like to ask about. This particular gentleman decided to go water skiing after maybe being overserved, and he went water skiing at night and wound up with this laceration from hitting a dock. And the organism you're most concerned with there is Aeromonas, freshwater injuries. Or medicinal leeches. I don't know how anyone could hold this in their bare hands, but they could. And so if there's an infection associated with medicinal leeches, it is Aeromonas. It's a normal part of their GI tract. They love to ask questions about nodular lymphangitis, where if you palpate these, you can just feel these nodules going right up an individual's arm. So there's a differential there, but it will be in the history. So if they work outside in a nursery, landscaping, something like that, the organism is sporotrichosis. The other history they will give you is associated probably with Mycobacterium marinum. And those are folks, well, this is more sporotrichosis here. What it looks like on a Gram stain, what the nodules or ulceration may look like. And Mycobacterium marinum is associated anything out there in water, cleaning your fish tank. Water injuries related to fishing. A fish hook gets caught in your finger, and a while later, you develop this nodular lymphangitis. Any sort of water-related history, think about Mycobacterium marinum. Splinter from a boat has been in the question in the past. Actinomycosis, so-called lumpy jaw. In medical school, we heard all about this. What we didn't hear about was the association with an IUD. So actinomycosis can present as a pelvic mass. The surgeons sometimes think that it's a malignancy, and it's often an IUD that's been left in a very long time. And of course, the first case I saw was a doctor's wife. Why? Because the IUD didn't bother her. So it had been in there like for years and years. And she presented with a pelvic mass. Surgery took her to debulk her tumor, and it turned out to be actinomycosis. More commonly, it's associated with dental disease and oral masses, if you will, that are indurated. and really not very tender. They're not very inflamed. So you can get fooled into thinking it's a tumor. But the gram stain will show this, these filamentous beaded gram-positive organisms. And then here's the differential between actinomycosis and nocardia. The lumpy jaw picture on the bottom is fits the description, not tender, not hot, and these lumps may just start to spontaneously drain. And they'll drain what they refer to as sulfa granules. Notice this is in gold or yellow. These are questions that have been asked in the past. What's the type of isolation? Would you put these individuals in with shingles? Mainly you cover the wound, some version of that. If it's chickenpox, it's airborne, but not for shingles. Hutchinson sign, they've asked questions about that. Most of you know Hutchinson sign. That is, if you have involvement in the tip of the nose, that tells you the eye is involved. And then they've asked about the Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, which is listed as you see. New England Journal pictures of blastomycosis. Probably the question would revolve around the fact that if it's blasto, you always assume there was a pulmonary portal of entry. So it's not a contact acquired infection. It's inhaled and disseminates. That's typical of blasto. The original article was a group of Boy Scouts, I believe Wisconsin, were up in Wisconsin doing what Boy Scouts do, which was digging up the beaver dam. So it's decaying vegetation, airborne, inhaled, and then dissemination. Because this isn't anywhere else in the topics we were asked to talk about, I'm just sort of fit this in here, is the typical questions associated with neutropenia and immunosuppression. What's the most common organism? E. coli. What's the most lethal? Pseudomonas. So, and which is the reason any neutropenic patient who's febrile, all antibiotics have to have Pseudomonas activity, whatever you choose. Piptazo, cefepime is the ER drug of choice for everything at our institution now, so I don't think anyone will die of Pseudomonas bacteremia. Or they might ask about this skin finding. This is ecthyma gangrenosa. This is actually Pseudomonas going to the skin and leading to necrosis. So it depends on the stage, but this is commonly seen. Well, it's not commonly seen, but when it is seen, it's usually due to Pseudomonas. They ask about Candida and endophthalmitis. They'll show you pictures of this and give you a setting where you would want to think about it, which is primarily in the severely neutropenic patient who's been neutropenic for a period of time. And if they have visual complaints, or if the exam is notable, as here, it's often as the white count is returning, not when it's still down. And the other risk factors, you all know. ICU, multiple lines, multiple antibiotics. You're just a setup for this. The pulmonologists love to ask about this. So this would be an immunosuppressed patient, diffuse pulmonary infiltrates, and this is what you see when they do their bronchoscopy. These are not visible to the human eye, to the naked eye. These are only visible under a microscope. And everyone who has not been really careful at that bronchoscopy totally freaks out when you show them this. CNS presentations. Neisseria, you heard a little bit about that earlier. The questions that they will probably focus on is, if it's meningitis with a rash, it's Neisseria. pneumococcal meningitis does not give you a rash. And they'll ask you about complement, terminal, so-called terminal complement deficiency. That's a gram stain on the right. Notice that gram-negative organisms are not that deep purple. They actually sort of, that it's that pink or red that blends in with the background. That's a gram-negative organism. This is a tricky question on the boards in the past. We know that Cryptococcus is not unique to immune-suppressed patients, but is much more common. It's very common in AIDS patients from Africa or in Africa. It's also not uncommon in HIV patients here in the States if they have advanced disease. But the question was not about HIV. The question was, what immune deficiency is seen with this so-called India ink? So be a little careful with that. It's T-cell deficiencies, which is part of HIV, but they didn't ask it in the context of HIV. They ask about what immune deficiency. Other questions. Meningitis with the highest mortality, pneumococcus, and all these other potential questions that folks like to ask about. Complement deficiency. Listeria, the most common cause of lymphocyte-predominant meningitis in a young, otherwise healthy individual, are the enteroviral infections, usually seen in late summer or fall. There are a million versions of this table out there, but you should know this table. And I made it really as simple as I could to distinguish between bacterial, viral, and either TB or fungal. But you should know this table cold, and it will help you in your practice as well. So this is actually practical. Disseminated gonorrhea, again, gram-negative organisms, and that pustule on the foot is not brown from the organism, it's brown from the betadine that they used before they tried to aspirate it. They love to ask questions about syphilis. These primary lesions can occur anywhere. The photo on the left is under a particular microscope that I wouldn't even know where to find one. And the diagnosis is usually made by PCR these days of an active lesion. Primary syphilis. Right out of New England Journal, they love to ask about alopecia in the context of syphilis. And I think any photo from New England Journal is fair game, because my bias is we should all be reading it. Disseminated syphilis. These are right out of the New England Journal. Rashes of the palms and soles. And the first case I ever saw of this, I totally missed. Not proud of that one. But I just wasn't thinking about it. And it was in a patient hospitalized for other reasons who was sitting there saying, "Doc, what do you think this is?" And not proud of that one. Secondary syphilis is just nothing more than disseminated spirochetes everywhere. They're considered highly, highly, highly contagious. And treated or not, the rash will go away and on into latent and tertiary syphilis. Those are the tests you might order. They might have asked the treatment of syphilis, which is why all of this is in gold. If it's primary, if it's secondary, or if you have, for some reason, you know when they contracted this for less than a year, there's your treatment. If you don't know when they contracted it, or you believe it's been more than 1 year, then it's benzocaine penicillin 3 weeks in a row. Or they will ask you about pregnancy and allergy. And the test answer is you must desensitize them and treat them with high-dose penicillin, although probably Rocephin is probably okay. If this is not going back, but go back to that Jerish-Herxheimer reaction. They ask about that. What is a Jerish-Herxheimer reaction? When you treat syphilis, you may get a so-called endotoxin release syndrome, or a transient septic picture. So they could easily ask you about that. So you decided to you tell your nurse or whoever to treat that patient, and half an hour later you get a phone call that Mr. Jones, I don't know what's wrong with him, but he looks really bad. And this could be the Jerish-Herxheimer. The treatment's supportive. They might ask you about malaria. They'd like to ask about the banana gametocyte, which is in that picture on the right, associated with falciparum malaria. Or more to this country, babesiosis. And they'd like to play some sort of games with the test questions because of the overlap of babesiosis, Lyme disease, and ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis. So babesiosis is seen in the Northeast. There's lots of it out there, and it's potentially lethal if you are splenectomized, but otherwise you can still become very, very ill from this. Present with hemolytic anemia without a rash. And there are some inclusion bodies that I'll show you here in a second, not seen in malaria. And there's how you make the diagnosis usually and the treatment. And there's the tetrad of babesiosis, the Maltese cross. Lyme disease, you all know about the target lesions, the rash of Lyme disease. This bilateral seventh nerve palsy is called Banwarth syndrome. They might like to ask you about that. It's debatable whether there is such a thing as chronic Lyme disease. I'm not here to get in that debate, but I don't think they could possibly ask you a question about it. Now, here's a distinction between ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. I don't have the time, and you don't want me to read to you. So, but these are the differences between the two. Here's a question that I think is ridiculous to ask, but they did. Okay, so this is a peripheral smear, and notice where the arrows are. These are called moruli, seen almost exclusively in anaplasmosis. And the moruli are basically baby anaplasma before they grow up. So if you see these little things on a peripheral smear, it's anaplasmosis. Questions about treatment failure. Again, all these last things I talked about overlap. Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, babesiosis. So they will throw a antibiotic at you, and the patient is a treatment failure. Why? Because that's not the disease the patient has, or they have co-infection. So you make a diagnosis of Lyme disease, you give them Augmentin, and they failed to respond. It's not Lyme disease, or it's not only Lyme disease, it's Ehrlichia or anaplasma. Or you give them doxycycline, and they failed to respond. It's babesiosis. And that's how the question has been framed in the past. And then It's been suggested that there might be questions out there about bioterrorism. So here's a typical case of cutaneous anthrax. And unlike most other tick bites and other skin lesions, these folks tend to be sick. People with bioterrorism-related anthrax, everyone seems to think they have pneumonia, and actually they don't. They have a widened mediastinum, and they may have huge pleural effusions that are hemorrhagic, but pneumonia is actually a small part of the picture. If I were to show you a Gram stain of a patient with anthrax, this would be right out of JAMA, the initial case of anthrax meningitis. And most of you are too young to have been part of that scary episode, but this individual presented to, I believe, in South Carolina, and he was an outdoors kind of guy. So when they did an LP, it was a bloody LP. This was a Gram stain, and it was anthrax, and everyone said, well, you know, it's no big deal. He's an outdoor avid hunter and whatever. So he probably got it from being outdoors, and it turned out he was just one of many cases from a anthrax terrorist attack. Smallpox. I find that hard to believe that anyone would focus on that these days, but you don't know. So this is what the rash looks like. The patients are very ill and they're characterized by severe back pain.